Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm happy to have as my guest Paul Auster, the author, most recently, of The Book of Illusions. His first book was The Invention of Solitude, a book that I'm crazy about, and it was followed by the New York trilogy, In the Country of Last Things, Moon Palace, The Music of Chance, Leviathan, Mr. Vertigo, Timbuktu. We've spoken several times. There are books of poetry, translation, nonfiction. And, you know, I've read all your books now, and they seem to be always about storytelling and the making of stories and the creation of stories in order to avert other circumstances. Where do you think stories come from?
I think stories don't come from anywhere. I think stories are the fundamental human activity that helps us define who we are, because there would be no coherence to our lives if we couldn't break down the things that happen to us into narratives. Reality is crashing in on us every second, and unless we can isolate the essentials from the inessentials and make a coherent linear construction of this, I don't think we can exist. I think it's that simple. We need stories in order to stay alive. Individuals need stories. Nations need stories. The whole world needs stories.
In a little tribute to you, Charlie Baxter said something I hadn't thought about before, that the book seemed to be improvised as they go along, that they're not planned in many ways, and that in a way it's a kind of existential writing circumstance, the invention of the next leg. And I thought especially in this new book, when suddenly it's it's prime mover, an ex-silent comedian named Hector Mann is suddenly, having left a Willa Cather story, he appears in a pornographic vignette. And I thought, gee, you know, where did that come from? Do you write them? Is part of the grace of writing them the constant invention?
The adventure of writing a novel for me is that I'm not exactly sure where I'm going. I begin with a plan. I have an idea. I have a sense of the arc of the story. The most important thing for me is not so much to figure out every detail of the plot, but to find the music of the prose and the rhythm of the events. And once I have heard that music and feel capable of transcribing it into language, I'm able to begin the book.
I had made the mistake once of thinking that there were influences on these books, and I've now found a different way to describe that. I think that the books are made of literature, that it comes the way the hero in Moon Palace comes at it. He's inherited, I think it's 37 or 36 boxes of his uncle's books. He has moved into his first apartment. He is going to college at Columbia. He doesn't have money or can't spare money, and he uses them to the cartons to make pieces of furniture. He puts his mattress on top of a bunch of boxes together, and he says to his friends, well, it's very wonderful to be sleeping on top of American literature. And I think in a way, at a certain point, he starts to read the books in the boxes, just as in this book, Hector begins to read the 19th century novels he's never gotten around to. And there's a sense that literature is something that becomes an omnivorous habit for the characters, and so of course their stories seem to come from every book in the world at once.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting thing you've said. I think you might be onto something. There is, I think, in me, and it's probably reflected in my books, this love of books and love of storytelling and love of literature. I had the most amazing experience just last week in New York City. I've been working on a project about Nathaniel Hawthorne, and the New York Review, which is now publishing very interesting books, is going to be putting out next year a fragment from Hawthorne's American Notebooks, which I've picked, called 20 Days with Julian and Little Bunny by Papa, which is a 50 or 60 page text that Hawthorne wrote in 1851 when he was living in Lenox. After his third child was born, his wife and oldest child went back to West Newton to be with her parents, and Hawthorne was left alone with his five-year-old son, Julian, and recorded for his wife, so when she got back she could see what they had been up to, the most charming, funny, and I think profound account of a man taking care of a child alone. So I wrote a long preface for this book, and it's going to be coming out in June. Edwin Frank, the editor there at the New York Review Books, and I decided that it might be a nice idea to use some facsimile pages of the notebook in the edition that we're going to print. So we set up an appointment with the Morgan Library, and we went and we held Hawthorne's American Notebook in our hands. It was, you know, a thrill. But then the curator there, this very nice young woman, seemed to be very happy that we were there, and she said, would you like to come down into the vault and see what we've got here? And we spent about 2 hours looking at things such as Thoreau's entire journal, the manuscript of Our Mutual Friend by Dickens, manuscripts by Balzac, even medieval manuscripts by Boccaccio and Boethius. The Consolation of Philosophy is in that vault. And, Michael, I walked out of there spinning, and as if, you know, I had hit the mother lode of all creative literature in this basement. It was a fantastic experience.
I want to acknowledge for a moment the New York Review of editions. I've been planning to do a show on them, but they're bringing back so many books that I can't give to people anymore.
Exactly.
That it makes me very happy that the New York Review editions exist, not just for the old books that they're republishing, but sort of lost modern classics like Jimmy Skylar's book, Alfred
exactly.
and Guinevere.
No, it's a wonderful, wonderful new undertaking that I hope gets a real foothold in the American reading public.
What we're talking about is the Book of Illusions with my guest, Paul Auster. What we have is an ex-silent film actor who has disappeared. A man who has lost his wife and children in an airplane crash starts to find a fragment of his films on a TV documentary about silent film, and finds himself laughing for the first time in months, having been given a certain kind of freedom by the settlement. He's able to travel looking for these 12 lost films, and he begins to construct a book about this Hector Mann, and is told that other works of his exist, that Mann is not in fact dead, that he has been producing movies on a ranch in Albuquerque for all these many years. And what follows is an alternation between what we suspect might be a shaggy dog story, a leg pulling. He suspects it too, but he is the quintessential kind man in a sense.
Zimmer, we're talking about the
David
the narrator,
Zimmer, the yeah. biographer of not biographer, the scholar
yes.
of Hector Mann. He's appeared before in Moon Palace. He took care of Marco, and we discover in this book that he'd named one of his children after Marco.
Very astute of you to yeah. discover
well,
that.
I was
I'm
happy
glad you
that
noticed
that he cared about yes. his friend. and so he is in that state that a reader is in of not knowing whether he's being told the truth at any given moment. And he's being led through the adventure that readers love most, real readers, the adventure of uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered about that in particular, because that question, is this all made up on the spot, or is it real, is one of the questions that only fiction can ask, because there are not very many other counterfeit realities. And I wondered about, especially in this book, how you counterfeit reality.
Well, I believe the story. I think that Zimmer is telling us the truth, and I think he establishes himself very early in the novel as a reliable narrator, because he's willing to share his darkest secrets with us, which is the utter mental collapse he goes through after his family is killed. And even to the degree of portraying himself as a man really unfit to live among other people. There's a scene early in the book where he reluctantly goes to a party with some of his old colleagues and behaves so abominably, so nastily to the people there that he's convinced that he should stay out of the world. And I think only a man who's honest enough to admit that kind of behavior can be believed. Therefore, when he does get drawn into the Hector Mann story, we believe it. I hope we believe it. I hope the reader believes it.
I believe it, but I'm talking about, in a sense, something else. I came to a portion where Hector had gotten a job as a night watchman in a barrel factory. And I thought, barrel factory? You know, this is both real and false at the same time. It's more than real and less than real as a detail. Or the name Sylvia Mears, who feels like she's come out of, you know, a pulp classic.
And, yes, well, that name, just I don't know where it came from, but it rang right for me. Sylvia Mears, and she leads Hector through one of the darkest passages of his life.
And these things feel, well, the woman that he meets, Alma, describes the new films, the later films of Hector Mann, as having an eerie poetry. And there is another phrase, a phrase of yours, ghost writing. And I think of these kinds of beautiful and eerie phrases and narrative techniques as being very central to your project. I suddenly understood this time that it's as if you take the idea of a page-turner, a book that you can't stop reading, but unaccountably the events in it, the phrases in it, the rhythms of the page-turner have been changed, and substituting for them are these eerie, more and less than real phrases, a language that's both vivid and dead at the same time. And it's sort of as if the page-turner has swallowed, like the whale Jonah, a whole different set of techniques for storytelling. So while you're still avidly moving forward, there are these phrases and counter-events and rhythms slowing you down.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, people do tell me that, you know, the experience of reading my books is this hunger to keep going and turn pages. But this is not my aim as a writer. It simply falls out that way. I think it might have something to do with the compression that goes on in the narratives that I finally write. I eliminate lots of material as I'm working. And I want to write books that are very propulsive, in that every sentence, every single sentence, every phrase within every sentence is somehow moving us forward and is essential. It means giving up many passages that you work very hard on and feel attached to, and yet if they're not quite serving the function of serving the book as a whole, then they have to go. And since so much of the material is coming out of my unconscious, I mean, I really cannot tell you where these things come from. And I don't know why I do what I do. I could not justify any single piece of writing I've ever made. It's the urgency that I feel writing the story, I think perhaps communicates itself to the reader.
I'm speaking to Paul Auster about his book, The Book of Illusions, published by Holt, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. But I think also, I read Hand to Mouth, it is that hunger to make a success of writing, or at least to make a living at it. You're an American, after all. Unlike Hector, who is Polish and doesn't seem to mind making movies that no one will ever see, the trick element of these books seems to be that they have the propulsion that spells success for another kind of novel, but it's not really interested in that success.
No, they're very contemplative books. They're all about the inner life. They're not adventure stories at all. They're about the evolution of human souls and nothing more, nothing less.
It's a fascinating thing, then, to find encased within genres that Americans have either invented, Poe with a detective story, or inherited. You know, we get our adventure yarns, as Mr. Vertigo clearly points out, from Jules Verne, and Moon Palace comes from there too. But I can't think of another writer who's thought of writing the novel of soul making and tucking it in between the covers of what looks like gangster novels and, you know, novels of mysterious voyage and mysterious lands. It's such a peculiar combination, coalition.
Well, I've never thought of it as peculiar. It's just simply what I do. It's not again, a conscious search for a method. The method has evolved within me over the years, and it's the way that I can do it. The method of writing that's most compatible to my sensibility. I've used certain genres in certain bizarre ways, I suppose, or at least alluded to them, but I've never felt that I've written, you know, a science fiction novel, or even finally a detective novel. But I've used elements of some of those methods of storytelling simply because those are very good and effective methods. In the same way that our beloved Cervantes used the novel of chivalry to make his Don Quixote, but then turned this into something completely different. I wouldn't want to exaggerate the cleverness of these books. I'm not clever. I'm very stupid, and I grope my way forward in darkness as I'm doing them.
It's almost like the autobiography of Chateaubriand, pages of which make their appearance in this novel. David, hungry for things that divert him from his grief, has accepted a commission to do a translation of the vast autobiography that has not been translated since the beginning. Well, it was, what, 1902?
Yeah, that was the last full translation of Chateaubriand's memoirs.
And it seems as if it's not only a book that is written out of loss and anguish and suffering, but to translate it, one would almost have to be suffering oneself, that mm-hmm. it's a book that needs anguish in order to produce its peculiar tones. And I wondered about that, because, as you say, there's a loveliness of prose, but it's very calm prose here. It's very meditative. I wouldn't call it essentially rhythmic, but it has a murmuring quality. It doesn't want to, it wants to purl.
Well, you see, my aim with the prose, and this is where all the effort goes, the conscious effort, is in the polishing of the sentences. I'm trying to write prose that will vanish on the page, something so transparent, something that points to itself so little that a reader fully engaged with it will ideally at some point forget that language is the medium of communication and get through the words into the actual story that's being told. And I know this is, it's an ideal, it's impossible ever to achieve it, but that's what I'm straining for. Total clarity, absolute limpidity, so that there's never a moment where you stumble and say, what the hell is he saying? No, I want to make it graspable so that the reader can take that ride with me and not feel that he's being thrown out of the cart.
One of the things that moved me very deeply in this book is that this man has been a late entrant into the world of silent comedy. He's after the greats, and he hasn't been known. He disappears, and circumstances contrive to make it possible for him to make movies without any financial considerations, without any concerns about audience. In fact, it's intended that these films will be destroyed before there is any possibility of an audience. So in other words, having been a pioneer in a form that was inventing itself and freed from commercialism, he becomes a kind of proto-Stan Brakhage. It's almost as if we were not tied to our commercial needs, our natural instincts would lead us, the book almost says, to the avant-garde.
Yeah, well, you see, I think you're missing something here in this equation, however, is that Hector is in a tragic situation, and he's made a pact with the devil, so to speak, because of some enormous guilt that he's carrying around on his shoulders. He feels that he does not have the right to make films anymore. And yet, filmmaking is the only thing he ever wanted to do with himself. And therefore, he makes this pact whereby he allows himself to make films, but will never show them to anybody. To me, this is, it's dark and terrible, and it undermines the very idea of what art is, which is something that human beings share with one another. You don't do it for yourself. You don't make films in order to burn them. And this is a soul in torment. And this is the only way he can figure out a way to do the thing he wants to do without compromising his moral convictions about who he is and what he's done in the past. So it's complicated.
Yes, yes. And still, the daughter of his cameraman, Alma, has said that the films have become as strange and beautiful as they are because they don't suffer from criticism on the one hand, mm-hmm. or economic restrictions of the sort that a studio would impose,
right.
at least, on the other. And so, you see, for me, it was my dream, I guess, is that everyone, if freed from certain constrictions of publishing houses, of time, of the need to make a living, would be writing books that we would read again and again because they would be so beautiful. The writer would be free to plumb the depths of the human soul, and that therefore there would inevitably be something extraordinary as a result.
But we are free to do that. Writers are free to plumb the depths of the human soul and to write whatever we want to. We are free. filmmakers are not necessarily free because their works cost so much money and it's so much a commercial enterprise. And we know the history of film has been a long struggle between, you know, the artists and the producers and the money people. But writers can do whatever we want, and we don't even have to publish the books, and it doesn't really matter.
Well, so you don't feel that writing for the draw is as soul-searing a prospect as making films with no intention of an audience?
No, I mean to say, yes, you want to publish, but I was at a point early in my life as a writer when nobody was interested in publishing my books. I had written several novels, and they weren't published. And I made peace with myself. I said, I'm going to keep doing this no matter what. Eventually, I hope and pray that they will be published. Maybe, you know, speaking at my darkest, most romantic moments, you know, after I'm dead. But still, I'm going to do this work, and I'm going to leave it behind. And I think it is possible to write knowing that you have a slim chance of being published. Think of Emily Dickinson, for example. She published, what, 3 poems in her lifetime. It didn't stop her from continuing to pour out this magnificent work. One of my very favorite writers, someone I translated, Joseph Joubert, the notebook writer of late 18th, early 19th century France, had no intention of publishing this work. It was only later. In fact, Chateaubriand, his friend, who brought this work out 10 or 15 years after Joubert was dead. Books get lost, too. Books burn up. Sometimes writers destroy their books. Think of poor Gogol in a frenzy of madness, burning up the second half of Dead Souls. You know, but if the book, if the manuscript survives, then there's a chance that the book will eventually reach other people. So we're free. I really think writers are free. And any writer who thinks he isn't is deluding himself.
I've been speaking to Paul Auster about his new book, The Book of Illusions, which presents, as you go along, a series of extraordinary illusions on their way to penetrating a truth before we see that truth go up in flames. It's really quite an extraordinary book. I enjoyed it very much. The publisher is Henry Holt, and thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Michael.
You can read the first chapter of The Book of Illusions on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in bus.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in frozen rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.